We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Next week, here on the campus of the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, some 2,400 students in middle and high school will be competing in the 26th annual Science Olympiad National Tournament. These are students from all across the country. They represent 120 teams, and they compete in more than three dozen events, things like astronomy, bridge building, chemistry, computing, and ecology. And an event like that certainly will tell you that there are exciting things happening in science classrooms across the country. And we do have young people, girls and boys, young men and young women who are very excited about science and doing science and being scientists. Now, at the same time, though, now for years, we've had surveys that show that America lags behind other industrialized countries when it comes to science education. So this morning in this hour of Focus, we'll try to talk about this and what our children should be learning about science, and in fact, whether scientific literacy is a reasonable goal for everyone, whether it's even achievable. And our guest for the program this morning, and someone who has done a lot of thinking and writing and speaking about this particular issue, his name is Charles Coble. And he is a founder of the Third Mile Group. This is an independent education and social policy organization that's based in Denver. He is regarded as a national expert on teacher education programs and teacher development. He is a former professor of science education and dean of 13 years at the nationally award-winning School of Education at East Carolina University. That's in Greenville, North Carolina. He also served for 6 years as vice president of university school programs for the 16-campus University of North Carolina. And as we talk about science education in this hour of the show, questions from listeners are certainly welcome. Now, you can do that in two ways. Here in Champaign-Urbana, you can call the number here locally, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so if that would be a long-distance call, we'll pay for the call, and that's 800-222-9455. If you would like to email, you can do that too. It's will-talk, so that's just the way it sounds, W-I-L-L-talk at illinois.edu. Certainly welcome calls, questions. We just ask people to be brief, though. That way we can keep moving and get as many callers in as possible. But certainly anyone who's listening is welcome to call. Dr. Coble, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We've certainly appreciated it.
Thank you.
There are a lot of things we want to talk about. Let me, as a general kind of question, though, make this observation. It seems certainly that we have had concerns about the performance of American students for a long time. It seems that depending on maybe what surveys you look at and how you measure this, that the United States ranks something like 24th or 25th in the world in science education. And it is something that I'm sure that educators have been working on and thinking about. But why do you think it is that we continue to see that on the average that American students do so poorly in comparison to students abroad?
Right. And let me just say something at first about these international comparisons, and that is for this idea of comparing achievement in science and mathematics across nations is a relatively new idea. That is, it's only about a 15-year-old or maybe 20-year-old issue or possibility, gaining comparisons across nations. And you can imagine it is fraught with difficulties. That is, are we comparing apples to apples, apples to oranges, or what? That is, are we comparing our students to a cross sample of similar students across these different nations? So over time, these comparisons have actually improved, so that at the very beginning of doing international comparative studies, we viewed with some suspicion, rightfully so, some of the results, because it was determined in some countries we were being assessed against some of the very most high-achieving students in those particular countries. But over time, those issues have been addressed, and the situation for the United States has improved since then for two reasons. Number one, the assessments are better, and we're really comparing students across sort of achievement categories better. And number two, we've actually gotten a little better about our work in science and math education in the country. Nevertheless, we still are not the shining star. We are among the also-ran nations. That is, we are not among the leaders of the world when it comes to our success, the success of our students. And disturbingly, it gets worse over time. That is, when you assess our students at the elementary grades in the United States, we're fairly competitive, and which is ironic because in the elementary grades, we probably have least stress on good science instruction than almost any industrialized nation in the world. But then when we get the middle grades, our comparisons internationally are slightly down, and when we get to high school, it's even worse. Mm-hmm. So we have an unblemished track record of losing ground internationally when we compare ourselves internationally over time. So there's something. Now, our students are not getting dumber over time. There's something that we're not doing over time that's happening. So even though our position relative to the rest of the world has improved, that is, now we're above some of the third world nations or developing nations, we still are not there competing with Singapore and Japan and Hong Kong and Norway and this sort of thing. So we've got our work cut out for us. So now I think I probably lost myself in your question.
Well, that's it. No. I think you did a really great job of answering the question and taking it apart and saying, well, okay, let's look at it this way. Maybe though, let me ask, and I don't know if here I am going to ask you the same question again in just a different way, but people would say that there have been points, certainly in the post-war era, when we've been very concerned about science and technological education and whether or not we have the people that we need to be a strong nation and have a strong economy. And, you know, so I'm sure for a lot of people, the benchmark is going to be the post-Sputnik era, which was the Cold War, where we were very concerned about being behind the Soviet Union. Well, I think that there are some people who maybe say we might actually be at a crisis point now that would be equal to that post-Sputnik crisis, where we have the same sorts of concerns about will we have the kinds of scientists and mathematicians and tech wizards that we really need to be economically competitive in the future. And as I say, maybe that's asking the same question again, but do you actually think that we are at a point at that critical point, and that it's something like what we were at back at that point?
Yes. In a way, David, I think we had a simpler issue to deal with back in 1954 when the Russians launched Sputnik. And I was a little paper boy back then, and I remember that day vividly because I was delivering the paper with a headline that read, "Russians launch a satellite." And I just sat there and looked up at the sky and tried to imagine, how is that thing staying up there? Why doesn't it fall down? Why does it keep going round and round? And it felt really strange to think about an object from the Soviet Union, which you got to, those of us who are old enough, remember, we had vilified them. This was a dangerous enemy with a piece of machinery circulating over our country. And so it seemed ominous, but it was all about military concerns then. They were a farming nation, and we were a farming. We were large to agriculture. We had gone through the industrial age, but we still had more people living in rural areas than we had in cities back then. And it was still possible in your state and in my state to graduate from high school or even not graduate from high school, go out and get a job on a farm or some textile factory here in the South where I'm living now in Chapel Hill, which, by the way, we have no textile factories anymore, but anyway, back then, And you can get a job, and you could do well, and you could buy a home, you could buy a car. So for the few of us who went on to college, from my high school at least, for a while it looked like we'd made an economically bad decision. That is, the people who dropped out, who went on the textile mills or went on the farms, they were actually doing quite well. I mean, they were married, had kids, had cars, and, you know, the rest of us were in debt. We were in college and didn't have very much. But what has changed is that now the kids in your area of the country, and certainly in the South, here in North Carolina, if they don't graduate from high school, there is no farm to go work on. Or if they're working on that farm, they are probably having a part-time job to pay the money to operate that farm, because they're not getting the kind of returns on their investment that they had at one time if they are a small farmer. And as I mentioned earlier, the textile industry simply collapsed in this state. And I'm not sure what the equivalent would be there in Illinois. But the industrial base has shifted dramatically. So now we don't just have a military threat, which was certainly scary enough back then, because when we thought about, wow, they have rockets that can actually launch satellites. And, you know, our Vanguard missiles, we tried to get off the ground down in Cape Kennedy. You know, they blew up on the site. They didn't even get up until, you know, months and months and months later. So now we're facing an economic challenge. And it's no longer who can build the biggest missile, but by the wit of your brain, can you put together ideas and technologies and products that are fostered out of our understanding of things we call science and mathematics. So we have now a situation in which the general literacy of our nation in the areas of things we call science and mathematics, not just scientists and mathematicians, and you made that distinction in your introduction. Scientific literacy is the general knowledge that people have about science and mathematics. Mm-hmm. Scientific literacy in this country is a problem. And so our ability to have people go into science-based industries, or more importantly, lead in the innovation of those industries, is threatened by virtue of our lack of competitiveness generally in this area. Now, let me say quickly that I'm not among those who say we need to chunk the arts and history and blah, blah, blah in order to do science and mathematics. That's not at all what I believe. But we do have to pay very special attention to the fact that the tools and technology which drive this nation are different from the tools and technology that drove the nation back in the mid-50s, and certainly back in the 40s and earlier. That is, it's no longer the back that's making the country work. It's the brain. And while we certainly have to have strong backs, we have to have smart and well-prepared brains. And that's where we have got ourselves in a situation where we had designed a public school system to do very well by a few and not very well by the many.
Yeah. Let me again introduce the guest for anybody who might just have tuned in, Dr. Charles Coble. He's founder of the Third Mile Group. This is an educational consulting organization that's worked with nonprofits, with schools, with boards, various kinds of organizations, groups of people who are interested in improving educational policy. He is also a former professor of science education and dean of 13 years at the School of Education at East Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina. He also served 6 years as vice president of the university school programs for the 16 campus University of North Carolina. And we're talking here about science education and what can be done to improve science teaching in schools across the country. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Certainly now in education, and for some time now in education, the big concern, one of the big concerns, has been student performance, what sort of goals we should be setting, how we get kids there, and then also how we try to determine whether they are there or not. So there's a lot. Proficiency is one of those words that one hears again and again. And one of the goals that we have, obviously, as well, we want children to be proficient in science. Now, having said that, then the question is, well, what does that mean exactly? What is it that we want the students to know and perhaps also to be able to do?
Right. Well, good question, David. And let me, I'll try to make some of these answers shorter. But let me point out what I think is the sort of the spectrum of problems. And you're on top of the biggest one right there, which is what do we actually want people to know and be able to do? By what age grade level? So here's the sort of the sequence of things that I think we have to work on. Okay, and we got to remember the United States has a very unique situation in terms of the education of its public, in terms of our Constitution. Unlike most Western nations on Earth, we actually have no provision in our United States Constitution about the education of the public. Therefore, as per our Constitution, all rights not enshrined in the Constitution are reserved to the states. And so it is a state's right and responsibility to design public education systems. And so we have 50 different constitutional provisions in states' constitutions that allow for the establishment of public education and within that, how they will be governed, who will set the rules of engagement. And in a way, it's sort of an ingenious situation because while we have no national educational standards, we have 50 state standards, and they are, in fact, then it gets more diluted because the state boards of education then also defer to each county or districts or some organization in the state that public schools shall be operated by either municipalities or school districts or some such local education agency, which are themselves overseen by boards of education. And we have over 14,000 boards of education or school districts in this state, in this nation, that have the responsibility for setting the answer to your question, the proficiency standards. So unlike a Japan or a Malaysia or a France, which used to have the sort of funny thing that what time is it in France right now, then we know that everybody is studying French history at this moment. Mm-hmm. You know, in the United States, we have over 14,000 school boards setting different proficiency measures. Some states are setting strong ones and defer and then holding counties responsible for it, but it's not that case in all states. So we do have a problem in setting proficiency standards. We're trying to compete against nations who have national standards, and we have state and local standards, and we have no agreement in these United States over what those standards are. Now, I can talk more about that, but I don't want to get that. Okay. That's almost my short answer to that question.
Well, I tell you what, I have a couple of callers here who'd like to get into the conversation,
sure.
So let's do that. And we'll start. We have somebody in Homer community, not that far from here, on a cell phone, so we'll get right there, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
There's been a lot of really interesting and thought-provoking points brought up here, but I've worked with very young children, zero and in the school system, for about 25 to 30 years. And what I notice is the raw materials for these children, in other words, the food they eat, the sleep they get, the amount of quality time they have, not in front of a television, but perhaps outside playing and interacting with their parents, has gone down considerably in the time that I've been working with children. And I work with children with problems of various end-up learning disorders. They start out with developmental issues and end up into learning problems. And I'm an occupational therapist. And these children, the caseload that I have has increased incrementally in over these past three decades. So I feel that there's a lot of good points being brought out, but until we can give our children the better raw materials for their brains and bodies to develop, I wonder how far we're going to get with some of the other pieces of the system. That's all I have to say.
Well, I appreciate the comment. That's in one sense, I want to say that's beyond what we're doing here. But on another sense, you have to say, well, that's actually the bedrock.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter whether we're talking about science education or reading or math or whatever. You know, success in school is going to have a lot to do with what kind of home life children have and what kind of deficits they may arrive with or what kind of advantages they arrive with.
Right. Yeah, let me respond to that. I so appreciate the observation of your caller because certainly in our state here in North Carolina, there was a time when soft drink machines were not allowed in schools. You could not purchase candy and sweets in schools. But because of the commercialization, the need to raise money and advertisement and all this sort of thing, which school boards certainly catered to in our state, there was a dramatic infusion of sweets and sugars and caffeine into schools. It's not incremental, it's exponential rise in obesity. And so the children are sitting in school, and as soon as the snack bars are open after lunch, they're almost in elementary school. I mean, it's very difficult to gain their attention because of their own sugar highs. So, indeed, the caller is making the point that in order to teach a good science and math program, you have to be able to sit there and deal with healthy children. And so these problems are all combined. And while it may be a sidebar issue today, it's an important sidebar, and I certainly appreciate your call.
All right. Well, I certainly appreciate the comment. I have another person on a cell phone, so we'll go there, and this is line number two. Hello.
Hello. I came in a little late, but I think this is probably one of there's so many issues in our country. I think this is probably a key one is perhaps the professor would like to lead a grassroots movement to improve the quality of our education in our schools.
You might have to say that again for me to hear it. I had an interruption on my line right when you got to the crucial word I think you were asking.
Yes, I think the word was grassroots. I think we need something from the bottom up that may be led by a few people at the top to change the direction of our education and our public schools back to education and away from some of these other issues that they have, like and things like that.
Right, yeah. Well, just to respond, certainly it is true that in America, the only way to really foster a long-term change is for grassroots, there to be grassroots concern about that and to express it upstream because of the nature of change in America, and that is because public education is a highly decentralized issue. Now, I don't think it's just grassroots, however. There has to be some thinking about ways of addressing these problems. Like, how do we in America deal with the question of common standards and assessments? And back to your issue, David, you asked earlier, what do we want people to know and be able to do by grade level and by graduation time and for entrance into the university or the world of work? What is that? Now, there is some really excellent thinking going on with some organizations that are not federal government organizations, that are membership or issue-driven organizations that are at work on trying to gain some standards in mathematics, common standards for algebra, for example. What you would think, well, algebra is algebra, but actually algebra is not algebra until someone defines exactly what it is. Well, there is a group working to get a large coalition of people in the country to agree to this and then make it known that here are the standards that we should adhere ourselves and voluntarily have the states commit to those standards and have people like the caller to get behind it and say, hey, look, let's get this in place for these kids so that we really are teaching algebra, not kiddie algebra. And so it is a sort of a top-down, bottom-up approach. approach, but it certainly doesn't work otherwise in our country.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I want to thank the callers. We're about midway already here in this hour of focus, and I'd like to introduce the guest once again. We're talking this morning with Dr. Charles Koble. He is a former professor of science education. He was dean for 13 years at the School of Education at East Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina. He also served 6 years as vice president of university school programs for the 16-campus University of North Carolina. He's regarded as a national expert on teacher education programs. He's also founder of the Third Mile Group. This is an educational consulting organization that has worked with nonprofits, with schools, school boards, people who are interested in improving education in this country. And we're talking here this morning specifically about science education. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Certainly what we're talking about, in part what we're talking about here when we're talking about proficiency in science, is having some kind of working knowledge of the natural world and how it works, and then have some kind of feeling for the process that scientists use to try to gain that understanding. Now, I think some people would say that when children come to school, they're not a completely blank slate. It's not that they arrive knowing nothing, but I wonder, in fact, do you think that the children of the past, so I guess I'd be thinking of like my parents, my grandparents, do you think that they came to school for whatever science education they got with a store of knowledge than today's children do? I mean, do they start? Do kids start behind?
No, actually, we have some evidence that just the opposite is true.
Ah. Mm-hmm.
That actually our children are probably far better. They have far more knowledge about science and mathematics than, say, certainly my grandparents did. I mean, this is hard to believe, but I had a grandmother who honestly believed that the whole moon mission thing was just simply fake, that you could not do that. I mean, and she was among the majority. But it isn't that our kids possess less knowledge today than kids in the past. They possess far more knowledge. It's just that the rest of the world possesses even more. In the industrialized world. Now, we all know that there's a huge dichotomy in the nations of our earth. And that is so we have many, many third world countries and aspiring nations who are not anywhere near the proficiency of our students. But that's not who we're competing with economically. We're competing with China and the combined nations of Europe and Southeast Asia. That's our competition. So the young men and women in Urbana-Champaign and in your listening area are not in competition economically with the people in their high schools. They're in competition with people they will never meet, and in nations they probably would have a difficult time finding on a map in many cases. So that's our issue. For example, 15 years ago, the United States was the leader in high school graduation rates among the Western world. Today, we're about 14th and 15th in terms of high school graduation rate. We have not reduced our high school graduation rate. We just plateaued. The 13 other nations have zoomed past us in high school completion rates. And so while we stagnated at about 75% of our students graduating, or 70-75% of our students graduating, there are many nations now that are 80-90%. So we're still throwing away talent. Mm-hmm. So that's our issue. We've stood still while other nations are moving out.
Let me. I have some other calls here I want to get rid of too. But just
sure.
in a way, if I could shift, let me ask you a sort of a little bit more practical question about what goes on in the classroom. I think that there are some people who would say that, well, one way that you learn about science is by doing science, but that there is this concern about the hands-on kind of experiences that kids have, particularly at the high school level. There's this concern that the lab experiences that students have are poor and that they don't really connect with the other things that they're learning in the classroom. What can you say about the ability of kids actually to do stuff, to get their hands on equipment and actually be doing experiments and things that actually are meaningful?
Yeah, David. I mean, yeah, that's a very, very insightful question because, you introduced the program about in relation to this your science Olympiad thing that's coming up there.
Right.
I mean, that's the kind of science that kids get excited about. They're doing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They have a problem to solve. There's an issue at hand. They have to put their minds on this work, and they have to manipulate equipment, do measurements, come up with schemes, you know, if you will, to solve a problem. And so it's not that it's so bad to memorize the nine planets and the classification system. It's just that you can't go anywhere with you can't do much with that. But if you put your head around, how do we get this object to move faster and change directions with even while it's accelerating down a track, you know. Okay, there's a lot of physics involved in answering that simple question I just laid out there. But unless kids have a chance to do it, they're only learning about science. They're not learning science. And so there's a big distinction between doing science and learning about science. And what you just pointed out was you put your hands on some stuff with some equipment and some necessary to make some measurements and really try out some possibilities, talk it over with your team, give it a shot, fail, let's try it again. Now, that's what science is. It's a system of experiments, failure. In fact, I interviewed Jonas Salk one time years ago. And, I talked to him about his failures. He had over 1,000 failures before he discovered polio vaccine. Well, when he discovered polio vaccine, he liberated a nation. So that's the kind of science we want in schools, not just more memorizing, for gosh sakes. In fact, that would be to the detriment of the interest of science. And it certainly would destroy the interest of kids who just want to know a little bit more. They don't necessarily want to become scientists. They just want to know.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with some more folks who are listening here. We'll
sure.
be going back to the phones, and we'll talk with somebody in Champaign next on line one.
Right.
Hello.
Is that me?
Yes.
Yes. Hello. I have a quick anecdote. Last year, I read James Van Allen's biography, early in it, he grew up in a small Iowa town. And, of course, went on to become the rocket scientist, I guess he was.
He really was a rocket scientist.
Yes, he really was. In fact, I think when they had Van Allen Day at the University of Iowa, he had a T-shirt that said, actually, I am a rocket scientist, okay? But from his high school experience, and I think he says this in the book, that the most important classes he had in high school were 4 years of shop, where he was in the shop just learning how to make things. And I think this culminated in, when Von Braun and the rocket people came to, I think it was Alabama, and they were just kind of practicing with these things. Van Allen said, well, instead of putting sandbags in these rockets, how about if I put scientific instruments? And they said, okay, fine, if you can make them. So he can, and he did. And so I'm just wondering about, because things like shop and things like how to run a sewing machine. I mean, in my era, all girls knew how to sew.
Right.
And that that while I appreciate what you're saying about standardizing and solidifying the actual science curriculum, I think, like in the general malaise of our country, where kids just don't know how to make things anymore.
Right.
And I mean, if somebody like James Van Allen says, "What made me a rocket scientist was 4 years of shop,"
right,
I think there's really something there. And I'd like to hear your response. So thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Yeah. Well, I certainly applaud what you said because, indeed, that's a whole. I mean, when I'm talking about standards and accountability, that sort of thing. I mean, well, Dave, what you said was what they know and are able to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a very sharp. That's good because it isn't just what people are able to memorize and give back to you. That's not being smart. I mean, that's being smart in a very limited way. It's what you're able to do. And so we've had sort of a false dichotomy in this country that you should either do shop or ag or do sewing and do typing, or you should do intellectual stuff, you know. And I grew up in that era where you couldn't do both. If you were going to go to college, you couldn't take the ag courses, and you couldn't take the practical courses. You had to do other stuff. And so really you were deprived of the capacity to really think and build and solve problems. So I think what your caller is pointing out is Van Allen, as soon as they sent that Vanguard missile up, on the first flight when it was successful, he had his instruments on the top of that satellite and discovered what we now call the Van Allen radiation belt in the very first satellite we launched. It is a matter of putting practical hands-on, as you said, David, earlier, with mind-zone. So hands-on, mind-zone is sort of a rubric that people in the science education field try to talk about and advocate for. And it's important. So I think she made a great point. Actually.
Let's talk with somebody on our toll-free line. This is line 4. Hello.
Hi. I want to kind of echo the last caller. Has anybody done a study that looked at the introduction of calculators into elementary school? It seems like most kids today, even high school graduates, can't do anything in their head, even a simple percentage. They kind of look at you with a blank stare and say, what are you talking about? If you ask them what 15% of 200 is or something weird. And also, because I'm old enough, junior high school did have required shop classes where you actually learned to do various odds and ends. And I've seen universities go from kind of all around people to demanding more and more, we'll say, academic pursuits. There's no appreciation, as you just pointed out with Van Allen, some mechanical arts or skills, unless you're going to be a mechanical engineer. I'm going to get off and listen. So thanks a lot for taking the call.
All right.
Thank you. Okay. Boy, there's a lot in that question. I think that, and such good observation, because it is. We have a tendency in the country to do pendulums really, really well, and that is so. We didn't allow calculators to be used in school, and so what we did was we solved. We solved the same problem sort of over and over again. We did every other problem, rather than getting to higher and higher issues. And so the calculators allowed us to accelerate the completion of certain problems. But you got to have a problem worth solving, not just some simple issues. Now, but the point he's making is a good one, and that is there is some reconsideration in some quarters of the world, education world, about, did we kind of overdo that? That is, have we really sacrificed sort of the mental exercises involved in percentages and multiplications, simple divisions, things like that, to the exclusion of just relying on a calculator? So I think we're in the process, frankly, of kind of readjusting that a bit so that we're saying, yeah, there's something to putting your head around it and not being totally dependent upon a calculator. And then putting a calculator in its proper place to allow you to accelerate through issues and problems that you know how to perform. But let's make sure you know how to perform them without the calculator.
We just have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Dr. Charles Koble. He's regarded as a national expert on teacher education programs, former professor of science education, dean of 13 years at the School of Education at East Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina. He also served 6 years as vice president of the university school programs for the 16-campus University of North Carolina, and now is a founder and partner in the Third Mile Group. It's an educational consulting organization. We're talking about science education. Questions welcome. I have another caller again we'll get to, but something I do want to talk a little bit here about is teachers. And I do not want to make it sound like I'm getting down on teachers, because they're heroic people and they're doing great work under difficult circumstances. But it does seem to be the case that we have significant numbers of teachers teaching science in middle and high school that do not have either a major or a minor in science. And I think some people have said maybe what we should be doing is doing our teacher prep differently, or somehow maybe we can encourage people who are science majors in college to think about becoming teachers. What's the teacher part of this look like?
Right. It's a very big issue. And on your campus or on the campus there in Illinois, I'm working with one of your really, esteemed colleagues, Lizanne DeStefano.
Mm-hmm.
She's a Fox Family Distinguished Professor of Education, and she's the director of your iSTEM Center there at U of Illinois. And she and I are working together on a national project called the Science and Math Teacher Imperative, they call it. And toward that end, we're focusing specifically on science and math teacher preparation because, teachers do a heroic work, and we have some of the best teachers in the world. We also have people absolutely unprepared to teach science and mathematics who are teaching science and mathematics. So what are they teaching? And that is what they know, and often that is what they've memorized. And so I am a lifelong advocate of teachers. I am still a licensed certified teacher in the state. And so there's no one stronger in support of teachers, around. But I also recognize that we also don't do that very well, and that is we have every state union has its different teacher standards and measures of teacher quality. So it's not just what they know. It is also, as you mentioned, what they are able to do. Mm-hmm. And so do we have the content standards, and do we have the pedagogical standards, and do we have the clinical practice that assures these people leave the universities ready to teach to high standards? But we have a problem, and that is when they're assigned in the classroom, if teachers who are not prepared to teach science are placed in classrooms where they are responsible for teaching science and mathematics, it is indeed not their fault. They are actually being asked to teach something for which they are not prepared to do. Now, when that happens, there should be requirements to support and monetary support, by the way, to send those people to programs and courses of support to learn to do what it is they are now doing. And it's in recognition, I think, David, of what you mentioned earlier. It's not just can you name the nine planets in order, or eight as we have now, but do you understand why they rotate and revolve and operate as they do? So it's the real doing of the science that they need to learn to do. So there's a huge issue related to just teacher preparation, which, again, is now back on the drawing board in terms of concerns that the nation, some thought leaders in the nation are trying to do something about. There has just been a brand-new report that was released this past week by the National Research Council called Educating Teachers of Science and Mathematics, Science, Mathematics, and Technology by the National Research Council. And so this report is bringing to light, once again, the importance of how we educate teachers, and we need to do a better job. They make a series of recommendations, which, by the way, this work that Lizanne DeStefano on your campus is deeply involved in, actually. So we have about a 10-year horizon here. We're going to continue to work on this issue, at least in this initiative, but there are many other people also trying to address the question you have.
Right.
Better preparing them and putting them where they can do their work.
About 5 minutes left here. We have some other callers. Next, we'll talk with someone in Charleston, line one. Hello.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I am a young new teacher myself at a community college right now. And I just probably have lots of stuff to talk about, but I'll try to limit it because I know our time. On my way to teaching, one of the problems I realized is that most of the focus in academics is on research. That's where they get a lot of the grants and money to build big things. So there wasn't a lot of opportunity for me to learn to teach and be under a mentor for teaching because my focus was so much research. So then when I moved into teaching, I was not as prepared as I could have been because the focus, again, is so heavily on research. Second point is, now that I am teaching, I was very disappointed, and this addresses your last point that you were talking about, some of the teachers just aren't prepared to teach science, math. I teach psychology, and whether or not that's science debatable, I suppose, but still we bring up a lot of biology, and I think it does require a degree, but they just hired somebody over me to fill the full-time faculty position who doesn't have a degree in the related field because they've been there for so long, mm-hmm. All right? And now my third point, I guess, is being a young teacher, I struggle to find a curriculum or assessment measures that don't just ask for recognition but ask for application.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the battles, like the struggles that I'm constantly fighting, is my class size. I teach at a small community college. You know, so our cap is about 32 students in a classroom. But I know at a university it can get 200 in a lecture hall. And I just don't I don't know how. It's never been taught to me, and we never talk about how to get application to that many students, especially when, you know, I have a decently full classload for part-time. You know, I have four classes, so I might have 135 to 200 students. I just don't know how to give application questions to that many people in a semester. Does that make sense?
Absolutely makes sense.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, that's an awful lot. But I really appreciate the call. Dr. Coble, you can deal with that however you think you can.
Yeah, and I know you're running close on time, but just let me say, first of all, congratulations to the young man for his work as a teacher and the struggle he's up against. And his observation's right on. I mean, in the United States, unlike any other Western nation on this in the world, we actually hire people and put them in classrooms to teach academic subjects for which they are not academically prepared to do. Now, that simply shouldn't be happening, and those are state policies that allow that to happen. So a good grassroots thing to do is for people to know what about the qualifications of their teachers, which, while No Child Left Behind had many flaws and does have many flaws, that's not one of them. And that information is supposed to be available to the public. Second thing is that his observation about what faculty are rewarded for is true. It's research not preparing to actually – so they get more rewards for researching about preparing teachers than they do for actually preparing good teachers. And so the clinical experiences and the rewards for faculty to do so is one of the things that Dr. Stefano and I and with some colleagues in D.C. are trying to work on, is trying to look at policies that give rewards to faculty and recognition to faculty for actually preparing effective teachers, not the highly variable condition that we have right now, that some can teach, some can't. Let's get good clinical experiences in there. Let's give time for them to learn, to practice. So the young man who just called in just had many, many good points about his own experience, which are validated across these United States. So we have our issues to deal with, and teacher preparation is certainly one of them.
Okay, let's try and get one more caller here. Line 2, Champagne. Hello.
Yeah, hello.
Yes.
I'm sort of just listened in the last 10, 15 minutes. I'm teaching here in the math department at the University of Illinois. And I grew up in Germany, and I wanted to sort of compare the situation a bit here to what I was used to in Germany. And there it is. In order to teach math and physics, for example, at a German high school, you have to have a master's degree in mathematics and physics, basically. And I find it amazing that sort of teachers here in the high school can teach science classes without having a sound education there. And the other thing is also what I find amazing is sort of the lack of basic knowledge, for example, in mathematics, of high school students who sort of then even attend the University of Illinois. I find graphics calculators are purely evil. I ask students to sketch a third order polynomial, and they took out the graphics calculators. And you can do it in your head. I mean, on the blackboard, and just sketch roughly how it looks like, and you get lots of information out of it. And they don't learn that in school anymore.
We just maybe have about. I'm really sorry to interrupt the caller because I really again appreciate the call. We only have maybe about a minute or a minute and a half left, and I guess I'm interested in seeing what Dr. Coble might have to say.
Yeah, absolutely. So we as long as we are largely ignorant of what the rest of the world is doing, we can feel good about what we're doing. But when we start facing honestly what we're confronted against, we can start blaming people or we can roll up our sleeves and go to work. The gentleman in the math department there at the university is making a very good point. That is, the standards of it and expectations globally are very high. And it's not just memorizing science and mathematics with his master's degree. They actually teach their teachers how to actually do science in the classroom. And that's the commitment that we got to have in this country. And it's programs like yours, David, I honestly think that help bring the attention of people what needs to happen and the demand more.
Yeah.
That's the only way it can work in this country.
One, here again, we're kind of up against the end of the show, but one thing I come back to is your earlier comment was, if you do comparisons where you're making a fair comparison, right, we see that kids here in elementary school are fairly competitive with students elsewhere. But what happens is that the gap starts around middle school, and by high school, it's really much larger. So you have to wonder, well, what exactly is happening there,
yeah,
if we get off to a good start, but then somewhere there along the middle, kids are starting to drift, and then by the time we get to high school, that there's a really big gap.
Right, right. And it has everything to do with, in the elementary school, we are child-centered. We actually give them things to do. They are excited about schooling, and so when we start shifting to memorizing about things rather than doing things is when we notice the drop-off of interest. Now, it's more complicated than that, but that's the short answer to that because I know you're up against time. But the shift in the way students are engaged from interesting activity to sit and get, as many people call it, is a big issue.
All right. Well, I'm sure we will get back to these questions on other shows, on other days, but for right now, we'll have to finish. Our guest, Charles Koble, he is a founder partner in the Third Mile Group. It's an educational consulting organization. He's also former professor of science education. He was dean 13 years at the School of Education at East Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina. Also served 6 years vice president of the university school programs at the 16-campus University of North Carolina system. And Dr. Koble, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.